She was the Democracy Now! Education Director for the last 13 years. She died on Monday after a battle with colon cancer. Samin was an award-winning independent producer, lifelong educator and activist. She's survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and their daughter, Ana Luisa Minou Fakande. We're going to go now to a clip of Samin speaking at the Allied Radio Conference in Detroit before the pandemic about her work at Democracy Now!
We have a broadcast from 8 to 9 live in New York City each day, each weekday. And my job is to do outreach to the education community, to colleges, high schools, middle schools, even elementary. And we have, at this time, over 1,000 students that come through our studio. So what we do is I talk to the teachers or professors. They will bring their students. So let's say a professor of philosophy or ethics or media studies, or a high school that is studying journalism or government. Or an English class, a middle school. They will bring their students early in the morning at 7:30. They will we show them our control room. We show them all the crew that's working, the producers, video producers, line producers, technical director, behind the scenes, and then we show them the studio as well. Then they sit down. At 8, the show starts, and they watch in our green room. They watch the show, both from what's going on to the air and also what is happening in the studio. So they see Amy Goodman, they see Juan Gonzalez, and they see the show guests. They watch the show, and after the show, we have a discussion about the show content and really try to demystify and deconstruct how media is made. And also, we talk about the issues, you know. So we talk about how is Democracy Now!, this independent media program, this news program, different from corporate media? How is it different from, say, CNN or ABC News and so forth?
When the pandemic hit in 2020, rather than closing up shop because Samin would shepherd classes through, conduct wide-ranging discussions with fourth graders, with graduate students in journalism, with journalists from other countries who'd come through the United States. But she simply expanded to doing Zoom calls with classes around the world, reaching thousands of students. Samin has been a long-time documentary filmmaker. She was a part of a group from Deep Dish TV and Paper Tiger TV that produced a series back in 1990 and 1991, before the Gulf War started, called the Gulf Crisis TV Project. This is Samin in one of those videos.
This series is made out of material sent to us by people all over the country who are currently speaking out against the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. Nationwide, people are raising questions, demanding information, organizing teach-ins, and finding out that they are a part of a major movement focused on peace in the Persian Gulf and the need to solve domestic problems.
Samin is survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and her daughter, Ana Luisa Minou Fakande, who graduated from Beacon High School just a few weeks ago and now heads to Sarah Lawrence College. Ana Luisa, we will all be there for you now and forever. I used to take long walks with Samin and our little pups, Zazu and Ziggy, through the Lower East Side. She particularly would take me to the gardens that she had fought so hard for, the community gardens of the Lower East Side, of which there are more than 100. Samin will be so sorely missed here at Democracy Now!, but her legacy will inspire so many. Our deepest condolences to Ana Luisa, to Eric, to her dearest friends and community, which is so large, which is global. Samin taught at Hampshire College, at the School of Visual Arts, as her work appeared at the Whitney and so many other places. Samin, your life has had so much meaning and will continue to. Samin Minou Luisa Mafakande Presente. That does it for our show. We thank everyone for being there for Samin and for Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016. Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regimes scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of zero, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies. First of all, rich democracies never die. The wealthiest democracies ever to break down, Argentina and Hungary, both had a per capita GDP of about $17,000 in today's dollars. The U.S. is four times richer than that. Second seemingly rock-solid fact about democracies is that old democracies never die. No democracy over the age of 50 is ever broken down. Even if we date the birth of our democracy at 1965, when we achieved full suffrage, U.S. democracy was over 50 when Donald Trump was elected. So we ought to be safe, but we're not. And we argue that the United States is undergoing an unprecedented transition, an historic transition, a transition to a multiracial democracy in which a previously dominant group loses its dominant status. That, we argue, has triggered an authoritarian reaction among a minority of Americans. But that's only part of the story. Our Constitution, unfortunately, is exacerbating the problem by empowering that authoritarian minority. All right, to begin with, the United States is becoming a truly multiracial democracy. The U.S., as you all know, has become much more diverse and much more racially egalitarian over the last 60 years. The number of Black and Latino members of Congress has more than quadrupled since my bar mitzvah. I'm not that old. From 28 in 1980 to 114 today. The number of Latino members of Congress has increased from 9 to 55. The number of African Americans in Congress has increased from 19 to 60. For the first time in history, the percentage of African Americans in Congress, or the percentage of Congress that is African American, is now equal to the percentage of the overall population that is African American. In 1965, all 9 Supreme Court justices were white men. Today, 4 out of 9 are white men. Only 6 of 9 are white. Public opinion has also changed dramatically in the last half century. For the first time in the history of the Republic, a majority of Americans now embrace the core principles of multiracial democracy: ethnic diversity and racial equality. Some examples. In 1980, a majority of Americans opposed laws to ban discrimination in home sales. Today, 80% of Americans support laws banning discrimination in home sales. In the 1990s, most Americans consistently opposed affirmative action. Today, more than 60% of Americans tell Gallup they support affirmative action and greater workplace diversity. More than 60% of Americans now consistently agree with the statement that the growing diversity of our society makes America a better place to live. And a recent poll, I think from last year, found that more than 60% of Americans think our schools should teach kids about America's history of racism, even if it makes kids uncomfortable. This is a big deal. For the first time in history, America has a multiracial Democratic majority. But our transition to multiracial democracy confronts 2 major challenges. I want to talk about these today. First, an authoritarian reaction, and second, a constitution that is amplifying that reaction. I want to take each of those points in turn. First of all, most fundamentally, United States democracy is in crisis today because one of our 2 major parties is no longer committed to playing by democratic rules of the game. Political parties that are committed to democracy, what the great political scientist Juan Linz called loyal Democrats, small d Democrats, loyal Democrats, parties that are committed to democracy must do 3 things, and this is taken from Linz. They must unambiguously accept the results of elections, win or lose. They must unambiguously reject the use of violence. And they must break completely with anti-democratic extremists. First 2 are pretty straightforward, so I want to develop the 3rd point, breaking with anti-democratic extremists. Single leaders, as powerful, as demagogic as they may seem, cannot kill a democracy on their own. They need accomplices among mainstream politicians. These are what Linz called semi-loyal Democrats. Again, small d Democrats. Semi-loyal Democrats can be hard to identify in a crowd. They look, they talk like regular politicians. The real litmus test, the way to distinguish a semi-loyal Democrat from a committed Democrat, is how they respond to the emergence of anti-democratic extremists in their own camp, on their own flank. When anti-democratic forces emerge on their own flank, loyal Democrats do 4 things. They publicly and unambiguously condemn anti-democratic behavior, even if it's done by their allies. They expel anti-democratic extremists from their ranks. They refuse to, say, nominate them for public office or support their candidacies. They cease all activities, both private and public, with groups that engage in anti-democratic behavior, and crucially, they join forces, or they're willing to join forces, with pro-democratic rivals from across the political and ideological spectrum to isolate and defeat anti-democratic extremists. This is Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Semi-loyal Democrats do none of these things. Rather than publicly repudiate anti-democratic behavior on their own flank, they downplay that behavior. They justify it through whataboutism or simply remain silent. Rather than expelling anti-democratic extremists, semi-loyalists tolerate them, accommodate them, sometimes even nominate them. And crucially, semi-loyalists refuse to work with ideological rivals to defeat anti-democratic extremists, even when democracy is on the line. In other words, they choose their anti-democratic allies over their pro-democratic rivals. Now, semi-loyalists may appear relatively benign. These guys aren't actively trying to kill democracy. They're just regular politicians trying to get ahead, trying to, say, become House Speaker, or regain a Senate majority, maybe stave off a primary challenge, avoid the wrath of the base. But history tells us that semi-loyal behavior inevitably strengthens anti-democratic forces. So when mainstream politicians tolerate or condone anti-democratic extremists, it normalizes them. Mainstream media outlets start to interview them like any other politician. Donors who once shunned them decide that it's okay to contribute to their campaigns. Leading consultants and pollsters start to return their phone calls. And politicians who once kept a distance now decide it might be okay to join them. All of that empowers and emboldens anti-democratic forces. A clear lesson from democratic breakdowns in Europe in the 1930s and in Latin America in the 1960s and 70s is that when mainstream political parties of the center left or the center right start to flirt or cooperate with extremists, democracies get into trouble. Since 2020, the Republican Party has violated all three of these principles of loyal democratic behavior. Not only was Donald Trump the first U.S. president in history to try to overturn an election, but crucially, the bulk of the Republican Party went along with it. A group called the Republican Accountability Project, a group of conservative never-Trumpers, evaluated the public statements of all 261 Republican members of Congress in the aftermath of the 2020 election to see whether they publicly cast doubt on the legitimacy of the 2020 election. 86% of them cast doubt on the election. This is crucial. Democracy requires that parties know how to lose. It's the cardinal rule of democracy. When a major party cannot accept defeat, democracy's in trouble. Republican politicians, or some of them, have also begun to flirt with political violence. They've embraced individuals, for example, who threatened or killed Black Lives Matter protesters. The McCloskeys, remember the McCloskeys, the St. Louis couple that drew their guns on unarmed protesters, were given a prominent speaking role in the Republican convention. Marjorie Taylor Greene nominated Kyle Rittenhouse. Remember Kyle Rittenhouse? Nominated him for a congressional gold medal. And during the 2022 primary season, the New York Times found more than 100 Republican ads in which candidates brandished or fired guns. I can think of no other major political party in any established democracy in which candidates so openly embraced violence. But the most dangerous feature of the contemporary Republican Party is its pervasive semi-loyalty. Republican leaders knew that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. And most of them in private were deeply troubled by his effort to overturn the results. But they enabled it anyway. They protected Trump by refusing to impeach and convict him. They blocked creation of an independent commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection. And nearly all of them say they will back Trump in 2024, even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election. It does not have to be this way. Think about what happened recently in Brazil. Brazilians, as most of you know, elected a Trump-like figure, Jair Bolsonaro, in 2018. The U.S. media called him the Trump of the tropics. Bolsonaro governed a lot like Trump. He governed pretty badly. And like Trump, he narrowly lost his re-election bid in 2022. And like Trump, he tried to overturn the results. But his own political allies refused to go along with it. All major right-wing politicians in Brazil publicly recognized the opposition candidate Lula's victory on election night. The president of Congress, all the leading governors in the country recognized the results of the election. In other words, the McConnells, the McCarthys, the DeSantises of Brazil, all of them unambiguously accepted the results of the elections on election night. Brazil had a January 6th-like event on January 8th, 2023, protesters stormed the Congress, the Supreme Court building, the presidential palace. But the Brazilian right uniformly condemned the insurrection. Nobody downplayed it. Nobody condoned it. Nobody defended it. In fact, right-wing politicians in Brazil pushed for a congressional investigation into the events of January 8th. And finally, whereas Republicans plan to back Trump even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election, the Brazilian courts barred Bolsonaro from running for the next 8 years, and conservative politicians have accepted that. They have not responded by attacking the legitimacy of the judicial system in Brazil. Bolsonaro is now an increasingly marginal figure in Brazilian politics. So there was another path. Republican leaders simply didn't pursue it. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that all Republicans are authoritarian. Many, many, in fact, millions of Republicans across the country are committed to democracy. But a failure to unambiguously accept election results, a flirtation with violence, and support for an openly authoritarian candidate are all clear signs of a political party that is no longer committed or fully committed to democratic rules of the game. So why is this happening? Why would an established political party like the Republicans, a party that's been competing peacefully in elections for more than 150 years, turn away from democracy? Again, in democracies, parties have to be able to live with losing. For parties to live with losing, for parties to tolerate losing, they have to believe that that losing will not bring ruinous consequences. When parties or their supporters perceive losing to pose an existential threat, they tend to radicalize. They tend to try to win at any cost. In other words, we argue that it is an outsized fear of losing that leads parties to turn away from democracy. Think about the Southern Democrats after the Civil War. This is if anyone accuses me of not being bipartisan, I'm going to rag on the Democrats. Reconstruction was this country's first experiment with multiracial democracy. It brought immediate and widespread black enfranchisement. African Americans were an outright majority or a near majority in most Southern states, most post-Confederate states. So their enfranchisement terrified Southern Democrats and their supporters. Not only did black suffrage threaten the Southern Democrats' electoral dominance, it threatened to overturn the entire racial order in the South. And for many Southern whites, that felt like an existential threat. So the Democrats abandoned any pretense of democracy. As one North Carolina Democrat put it, we cannot outnumber the Negroes. And so we must either outcheat, outcount, or outshoot them. And that's what they did. The Democrats used a combination of violent terrorism and election fraud to seize power across the South. They then entrenched themselves in power by using poll taxes, literacy tests, and other measures to wipe out African-American voting rights. Unwilling to lose, Southern Democrats stripped the right to vote from nearly half the population, ushering in nearly a century of authoritarian rule in the U.S. South. We fear that something similar, or at least parallel, is happening to the Republican Party today. The Republicans are a party of a majority ethnic group, white Christians, whose electoral and social dominance began to be threatened in the early 21st century. And the origins of that dynamic lie in the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1950s and the 1960s. That, the Civil Rights Revolution, was America's second experiment with multiracial democracy. When the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, the Republicans were very clearly a minority party. They had been since the New Deal. But the Democrats' embrace of civil rights over the course of the 1960s and 70s alienated many of their racially conservative white voters. And that was especially true in the South, where the vast majority of white voters were Democrats. That fact, the alienation of many white racially conservative voters, created a political opportunity for the Republicans. So beginning with Goldwater, continuing with Nixon and with Reagan, the Republicans pretty systematically for about 20 years appealed to white resentments. And that strategy worked pretty well. Southern whites, over the course of 30 or 40 years, went from being overwhelmingly Democrats to being overwhelmingly Republicans. And the Republicans, over the course of the latter part of the 20th century, established themselves quite effectively as the party of self-identified white Christians. They've won the white vote in every presidential election since 1968. Because 80% of Americans self-identified as white and Christian in the 1970s and 80s, the Republicans achieved quite a bit of electoral success with this strategy. They ceased to be a minority party. In fact, the Republicans won every single presidential election between 1968 and 1988, except for the Watergate election of 1976. But the strategy eventually ran into trouble, because while the Republicans were becoming America's white Christian party, America was becoming less white and less Christian. The percentage of Americans who identified as white and Christian fell from 80% in 1976 to 43% in 2016. That had a couple of implications for the Republicans. First of all, it posed an electoral challenge. A reliance on white Christian votes made it hard, not impossible, but made it harder for the Republicans to win national majorities in the 21st century. In fact, the Republican Party has not won the popular vote since 2004. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won 55% of the white vote, translated that into a landslide election victory. 32 years later, 2012, Mitt Romney won a whopping 59% of the white vote, still lost. When Republicans realized they were winning the white vote but losing the American vote, they started to panic. And that's when we saw the first, at least in the recent era, state-level efforts to make it harder for people to register and vote, 2011, 12, 13. But the problem went way beyond just losing elections. For a part of the Republican base, the rise of multiracial democracy felt like an existential threat, because white Christians were not just any group. They were historically a dominant group. They sat atop all of the country's social hierarchies, right? For two centuries, every single president, every vice president, every House Speaker, every Senate Majority Leader, every Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, every Federal Reserve Chair, every Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a white man. All the way through my bar mitzvah, every single governor, every single Fortune 500 CEO, every flippin' Miss America was white. All of that is now ending rapidly, relentlessly, right before our eyes. We see it in the quadrupling in the number of Black and Latino members of Congress since the 1980s. We see it in the growing presence of non-white and multiracial families on our TV screens and ads and movies. We see it in mounting societal pushback against acts of racism. Think of the Black Lives Matter protests. And we see it in challenges in classrooms, in newsrooms, to historical narratives that downplay or ignore America's racist past. We are witnessing in our lifetimes an unprecedented assault on this country's racial hierarchies. But when your group is on top of the hierarchy, challenges to that hierarchy can feel threatening. Losing one's dominant social status can generate feelings of loss, of resentment. It can feel like an existential threat. Many Trump voters, not all, many Trump voters feel like they're losing their country. They feel like the country they grew up in is being taken away from them. And that sense of loss has pushed many rank-and-file Republicans toward extremism. In a survey taken 2 years ago, 56% of Republicans agreed with the statement that the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. 56%. Now, the Republicans' radicalization would pose much less of a threat if the United States were like other democracies, where electoral majorities govern. In just about every Western democracy, there are 20, 25, maybe 30% of voters who sympathize with what we call far-right positions. But in no other established democracy has that 25 or 30% translated into so much political power. Again, Trump and MAGA have never, not for a day, represented a majority of Americans. Surveys show that majorities of Americans, again, embrace the principles of multiracial democracy. America now has a multiracial democratic majority. But that majority has hurled itself against some of the world's most powerful counter-majoritarian institutions. Now, let me be clear. counter-majoritarian institutions are a mouthful. They are also essential to democracy. Modern democracy requires the protection of minority rights. Not everything can or should be up for grabs in an election. As Justice Robert Jackson famously put it, some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities. I want to suggest that two domains in particular absolutely must be placed beyond the realm or the reach of majorities. The first is civil rights. Civil liberties like the right to vote, free speech, freedom of association, assembly, freedom of conscience must be protected from the whims of the majority. Pretty obvious. A second domain that must be beyond the reach of majorities is the democratic process itself. Elected governments can't be able to use popular or parliamentary majorities to entrench themselves in power. For example, by changing the rules of the game to undermine competition or weaken their opponents. That's the kind of tyranny of the majority that we saw in Chavez's Venezuela, with Orban in Hungary, and with Netanyahu's judicial reform in Israel. So we need to have, every democracy must have mechanisms to protect the democratic system from majorities that would subvert it. So civil liberties and the right to fair competition are essential minority rights. They are rights that require counter-majoritarian institutions. So institutions like the U.S. Bill of Rights, an independent judiciary with some review power, and relatively high barriers to constitutional reform, these are what I would call essential counter-majoritarian institutions. But not all counter-majoritarian institutions are essential to democracy. In fact, some of them subvert democracy. So just as some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities, other domains, I would argue, must remain within the reach of majorities. And let me just mention two. One of them is elections. Those with more votes should prevail over those with fewer votes in determining who holds political office. To my knowledge, no theory of liberal democracy justifies any other outcome. A second domain that ought to remain within the realm of majorities is legislation. Those who win elections should govern. Partisan minorities should not be able to permanently veto legislation that's backed by parliamentary majorities, provided that legislation doesn't violate basic rights. Institutions that prevent electoral majorities from winning or that prevent parliamentary majorities from governing are not essential to democracy. In fact, they are antithetical to democracy. The U.S., it turns out, has an unusual number of these undemocratic institutions. The Electoral College, which allows losers of the popular vote to win the presidency. A severely malapportioned Senate that provides equal representation to all states, regardless of their population. The Senate filibuster, which is not part of the Constitution, but allows a partisan minority to permanently block legislation backed by a majority. And of course, a powerful Supreme Court with lifetime tenure for justices, which allows justices appointed in one generation to thwart majorities for generations to come.
You're listening to Stephen Levitsky, Tyranny of the Minority. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, undemocratic counter-majoritarian institutions are often a product of transitional political pacts, pacts in which powerful authoritarian forces demand special protections in exchange for giving up power. We saw this, for example, in post-Pinochet Chile. We saw it with the Polish communists in 1989. We saw it with whites in South Africa. We see it with the military in contemporary Thailand. In all these cases, authoritarian forces demanded extra protection, a sort of leg up in exchange for giving up power. Now, we don't usually think of the United States, of our counter-majoritarian institutions, in these way, right? We usually think of our counter-majoritarian institutions as a product of far-sighted design. We think of it as part of a carefully crafted blueprint for checks and balances. That, I want to suggest, is in large part a myth. The framers of the U.S. Constitution were very smart folks. But they weren't out there trying to design the perfect republic. They were trying to hold the Union together and prevent a descent into civil war or foreign military intervention. And to do that, to prevent a breakup of the Union and a descent into violence, they realized very quickly that they had to compromise. Madison and Hamilton, two of our most brilliant framers, opposed equal state representation in the Senate. But when small states threatened to bolt the Union, they had to compromise. Madison wanted the Congress to select the president, like contemporary parliamentary systems in Europe. And he, Madison himself, preferred direct presidential elections to the Electoral College. But Madison's Virginia plan, which would have the Congress elect the president, was voted down. And Southern slave states rejected direct elections. So the Electoral College ended up being a sort of third best solution after all the other alternatives were voted down. The filibuster was also not part of the framers' vision for checks and balances. Both Hamilton and Madison strongly opposed supermajority rules for regular legislation. Supermajority rules were not included in the Constitution, not for regular legislation. They were not included in the original Senate. The filibuster emerged later thanks to a sort of weird oversight by early 19th century Senate leaders who were cleaning up the chamber's rules. And it wasn't until late in the 20th century that it actually became a supermajority rule on all legislation. So key counter-majoritarian institutions, things like the Senate and the Electoral College, were not a product of far-sighted design. They were a product of transitional pacts. But whereas transitional pacts in Poland, in Chile, in South Africa were temporary, America's counter-majoritarian institutions, for the most part, became permanent features of our political system. And those permanent features, I want to suggest, now threaten our democracy. The concessions made to small states in 1787 built a bias into our political system. It overrepresented sparsely populated territories. So the Electoral College favors sparsely populated states. The U.S. Senate heavily favors sparsely populated states. And because the Senate approves Supreme Court nominees, the Supreme Court is also mildly biased towards sparsely populated states. That rural bias has always been with us. It's always been undemocratic. But it never seriously advantaged one political party over another because for most of this country's history, both major parties had urban and rural wings. So it didn't really have a partisan effect. It's only in the early 21st century that U.S. parties have split markedly along urban-rural lines. Today, Democrats are overwhelmingly based in metropolitan centers, while Republicans are overwhelmingly based in more sparsely populated territories, smaller towns. That gives the Republicans, through no fault of their own, a systematic advantage in the Electoral College, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, which allows them, importantly, to win and hold national power without winning national electoral majorities. The Republicans have won the popular vote for president once since 1988. They've controlled the presidency for most of the 21st century. A popular majority was not enough for Joe Biden to win the presidency in 2020. He had to win by 4 points. Had he won by 3 percentage points, Trump would have been reelected. The Senate is even more skewed. In recent years, the Democrats have needed to win the popular vote in the Senate by about 5 points to retain control. So even if the Democrats consistently win 51, 52% of the national vote for the Senate, the Republicans will control the Senate. Senators, as you know, are elected to staggered 6-year terms. So a third of the chamber is up for election every 2 years. That means it takes 3 elections over a 6-year cycle to fully elect or renovate the Senate. The Democratic Party has won the overall popular vote in every 6-year cycle since 2000. And yet the Republicans have controlled the Senate for nearly half that period. The composition of the Supreme Court is also skewed. 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices were confirmed by senators representing less than half the U.S. population, and 3 of them, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, were nominated by a president who lost the popular vote and then confirmed by senators who represented less than half the population. If the popular vote determined who won the presidency and who controlled the Senate, the Supreme Court today would likely have a 6-3 liberal majority. So our institutions increasingly allow those who win fewer votes to govern those who win more votes. That is minority rule. But I want to suggest that the problem goes deeper than that. Our institutions are beginning to reinforce authoritarianism in a couple of ways. First of all, importantly, counter-majoritarian institutions reinforce Republican extremism by shielding the party from competitive pressure. Democratic competition is supposed to work kind of like a market. So when products don't sell, firms lose money. And when firms lose money, they face pressure to probably change their CEO and develop a better product. In democracies, parties are supposed to win votes. They're supposed to win elections. When parties repeatedly lose elections, they face pressure to adapt and broaden their appeal. So when the Democrats lost 3 consecutive presidential elections in 1980, 84, or 88, they responded by moving to the center and picking Bill Clinton, a moderate, as their presidential candidate. That's what parties are supposed to do when they lose. That process of adaptation is not happening in the Republican Party. Again, the Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 out of the last 8 presidential elections. They badly underperformed from all perspectives in 2018, in 2020, in 2022. And yet there has been no real effort to moderate or to rethink strategy. And that's because our institutions give the Republicans an electoral crutch. They don't have to win national majorities. They can wield a heck of a lot of power with 47, 48% of the vote. So extremism doesn't cost the Republicans today the way it would in a more competitive environment. Despite everything Trump has done, national power remains tantalizingly within reach for the Republican Party. They are very likely to win control of the Senate in 2024. They've got a pretty good chance of winning the presidency. So why moderate? There's also a danger, I think, that our counter-majoritarian institutions will be self-reinforcing, that they'll help to entrench anti-democratic forces. In politics, power begets power. The Republicans won the presidency and the Senate in 2016, despite losing the popular vote for both of those institutions. Trump and that Senate, that president and that Senate, then went on to fill 3 Supreme Court seats, forging a powerful right-wing majority in the court out of electoral minorities. That Supreme Court, in turn, has enabled state-level authoritarianism, upholding, for example, gerrymandering schemes that permit minority rule in several state legislatures. And in states like North Carolina and Wisconsin, gerrymandered state legislatures have launched a range of anti-democratic initiatives, including measures making it harder to vote. Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. Why is that the case? Counter-majoritarian institutions used to be really widespread. States in 19th century Europe had all sorts of undemocratic institutions. By comparison, the U.S. was a progressive democratic regime. European countries had monarchic vetoes. They had indirect elections. They had unelected or badly malapportioned legislative chambers. They had filibuster-like mechanisms through which parliamentary minorities could thwart majorities. They had all of those things. But over the last roughly 100, 120 years, other democracies gradually shed their pre-democratic institutions. So Britain weakened its House of Lords, stripping it of veto power. Denmark, Sweden, Portugal, New Zealand got rid of undemocratic upper chambers. Germany, Austria, Belgium democratized their senates by making them more proportional to the population. Britain, Canada, France, and other democracies established cloture rules that allowed simple majorities to end parliamentary debate, thereby eliminating the possibility of a minority filibuster. All other established democracies imposed term limits or retirement age on their Supreme Court justices, and every other presidential democracy on earth, every one of them, got rid of its electoral college. Argentina was the last one in 1994. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. So today, again, the United States is the world's only presidential democracy with an electoral college. We have the most malapportioned Senate in the world, except for Argentina and Brazil. No other democracy allows a parliamentary minority to routinely veto legislation that's backed by the majority. The United States is the only established democracy with lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court. Every other established democracy has either term limits or mandatory retirement age. And finally, among democracies, the U.S. Constitution is the hardest in the world to amend. We need to democratize American democracy. We propose 15 reforms that would help to ensure that electoral majorities win power and govern. Those reforms include a constitutional right to vote and automatic voter registration, include abolition of the Electoral College, democratization of the Senate by eliminating the filibuster and giving more populous states greater representation, and establishing term limits for Supreme Court justices. These are not radical reforms. They already exist in most other democracies. Making it easier to vote, abolishing the Electoral College, eliminating the filibuster, and ending lifetime tenure on the court would simply bring us in line with other established democracies. Now, constitutional reform is really difficult in the United States, but it's worth remembering that Americans have a long history of working to make our political system more democratic. Back in 1787, George Washington wrote a letter to his nephew in which he described the new Constitution, written just weeks earlier, as an imperfect document and said that it would be up to future generations to make it better. And generations of Americans did just that, from the Bill of Rights to the expansion of suffrage to the important Reconstruction Amendments to the Progressive Era reforms to the Civil Rights Era. Americans worked to make our system more democratic. But over the last half century, over the course of most of our lifetimes, we have stopped doing that work. We need to get back to that reformist tradition, and we need to put institutional reform back on the public agenda. We need to start discussing it. If we don't, we risk a slide into minority rule. But, and here I will end, none of this stuff's going to happen before 2024. And in the meantime, we face an imminent authoritarian threat. It is now clear, if it wasn't in 2016, that Donald Trump is an autocrat, right? He violated the cardinal rule of democracy when he tried to overturn the 2020 election. And he's been quite clear, if you've been listening to him, about what he will try to do if he's elected in 2024. He says he will purge the public administration and pack it with loyalists. He says he will use the Justice Department to prosecute and jail his critics. And he says he will try to shut down critical media outlets. I cannot, frankly, think of another major candidate in competitive elections anywhere in the world since World War II who's been as openly, nakedly authoritarian as Donald Trump. Hugo Chavez never said anything like this on the campaign trail. Erdogan and Orban never said this stuff. Not even Putin made such openly authoritarian promises. Given the pervasive semi-loyalty within the Republican Party today, Trump constitutes a far greater threat to our democracy today than he did in 2016. It is therefore imperative that we build a broad coalition in defense of democracy, one that is much broader than anything we are contemplating today. That coalition has to include everybody from AOC and Bernie Sanders to Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, George Bush, and conservative religious and business figures. Building a broad coalition, and this is important, requires sacrifice. It requires working with people we've opposed our entire lives. It requires setting aside major policy differences, even on issues that we care deeply about, things like Israel, abortion. That's a big ask, but these are not ordinary times. If we behave as if we are in ordinary times, we could lose our democracy. We stand at a crossroads today. America will either be a multiracial democracy in the 21st century, or it will not be a democracy. Both of those roads lie before us, and there is no turning back. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I have two questions. One is about the role of the military. Prior to January 6th, there was a statement issued by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that said if President Trump were to issue some sort of edict to use the military against peaceful protesters, that they would absolutely not obey that from their commander-in-chief. And it seems that the more authoritarian our politics get, the larger the role of the military may come. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. And also our very unique gun culture playing such a big role in campaigning. If you'd like to or could elaborate on the role of being the most heavily armed nation on Earth and the threats to our democracy, that seems to me to be incredibly portending of a problem.
So the military is a real asset for U.S. democracy. I mean, I should be clear. U.S. democracy survived the first Trump presidency, and that is no small achievement. Extremely important. One of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons why U.S. democracy survives, we have a number of very strong institutions. One of them is institution of civilian control over the military. And I think and we have a very, very professionalized military that's committed to the Constitution. Now, but it's also committed to obeying orders of civilian presidents. So and this is a problem that has occurred in other democracies in the world. When an elected civilian president who has authority over the military, constitutional authority of the military, orders the military to do undemocratic things, it puts the military in a very, very difficult bind. And military leaders, as you pointed out, worried a lot about that in 2020. And with Trump saying that one of the first things he plans to do is use the Insurrection Act against protesters, I'm sure they're worried about it now. It is a very, very big advantage. What Trump tried to do in 2020, 2021 is very recognizable to a scholar of Latin America like me. It was an attempted presidential coup, an autogolpe. Somebody didn't tell Trump this, but you can't succeed in a presidential autogolpe without cooperation of the armed forces. And so thank God he didn't have that. So the fact that we have a very, very professional military is an asset, and I think will continue to be an asset for a while. Gun culture is, I'm not one of those who thinks that the United States is at a high risk for civil war. I do think we are at risk for a high level of political instability, of regime instability. I think we're headed, certainly in the worst case, for a period of constitutional crisis, sort of sliding in and out of crisis, that probably will be accompanied by a moderately high level of violence. Very difficult to predict how much, but it's not unreasonable to imagine if we slide back into crisis that there will be a fair level of street violence. There already was some in 2020, that there could be political assassination attempts and terrorist attacks. And the fact that so many Americans, and particularly radicalized Americans, own guns doesn't help.
My question for you is, I agree with your reforms, but I'm worried that maybe they'll lead to political instability, that if we democratize, it will create resentment in rural areas, in predominantly white areas. So how do we alleviate those fears, you know, on this path towards democratization as a result of that actually leading to more political instability and then the fracturing of our country?
Perhaps fortunately, our political system is really hard to reform. And so the prospect of even minor reforms, like making it easier to register and vote, doesn't take constitutional reform, or eliminating the filibuster, even those things are really difficult. And constitutional amendments are not around the corner. So our goal is to begin a public debate about reforms. We do not anticipate that there'll be a calling of I don't even support the calling of a constitutional convention to impose all these reforms in one swoop. Even in the best of scenarios, a handful of these reforms will happen over the course of your lifetime. So my hope is that the inevitably gradual nature of the reforms are such that they won't have the kind of alienating impact that you, I think, correctly foresee.
My name is Michael Forbes, and I'm with the Inspired Leadership Initiative, a fellow here at the University of Notre Dame. I'm also a former member of the United States House of Representatives. Mike, thank you, Professor, because you are spot on. I am terrified that our democracy is slowly ebbing away. We saw what happened, obviously, under Trump and many things that you just referenced. I'm concerned, number one, the Voting Rights Act has been diluted to such an extent and the Congress will not deal with, you know, renewing the Voting Rights Act in the proper way. And it's just a further evidence that our democracy is slipping away. President Biden himself said he would not encourage them to do away with the filibuster in the United States Senate. And I really do thank you for what you're saying, because without being alarmist, it is very, very real that this democracy is at stake. And I'm wondering if you could just comment on the idea that, you know, some of the time and treasured initiatives that came out of the Johnson administration, like the Civil Rights Act and like the Voting Rights Act, have, you know, been diluted to such an extent that it's emboldening the minority. You mentioned the Electoral College, and again, nobody seems to want to take up that fight, unfortunately. And so we are looking at a very serious situation in 2024, if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Sure, thanks. Just a couple of things really briefly. I mean, we tend to think of Electoral College reform as impossible, and certainly it's not likely in the months to come. But we actually came, some of you will remember, very, very close to abolishing the Electoral College in 1969 and 1970. Both parties supported abolition of the Electoral College. President Nixon supported abolition of the Electoral College. The Chamber of Commerce, the American Bar Association, the AFL-CIO all supported abolishing the Electoral College. More than 70% of Americans did. It overwhelmingly passed the House. It had a majority in the Senate, but didn't get to the two-thirds of the Senate needed to push it forward. So it fell prey to the fact that it's really hard to amend our Constitution. So we've been close before. I don't think we're quite as far as we sometimes think. In terms of the voting rights, I mean, efforts, I don't think the Civil Rights Act is in the same kind of danger, but U.S. is really a very unique democracy in that it is always, governments have always made it kind of hard for Americans to vote. In most democracies in the world, certainly all the democracies that I know, government makes it easy to vote. The government sees it as its job to make it easy for citizens to vote. In some countries, it is mandatory to vote. It's considered a civic duty to vote. And in other countries, many other democracies, you automatically become registered to vote when you turn 18. In almost every other democracy on earth, election day is either a Sunday or a holiday, so it's easy to vote. Only in this country, going all the way back to the 18th century, has it always been a struggle to register and vote. And so there have been efforts to pass voting rights legislation to kind of build back after what the Supreme Court struck down of the Voting Rights Act. That legislation fell prey to the filibuster. And there are, as you mentioned, a serious debate in the Democratic Party about the wisdom of eliminating the filibuster. I actually had the good fortune of discussing this with a bunch of Democratic Party senators over Zoom. And a bunch of them pushed back hard and said, dude, we're going to be in the minority in the Senate after 2024. Don't take away our filibuster. We want to be able to block Trump. And it makes sense. If I were a senator, I would think similarly. But from a Democratic standpoint, small d, majorities have to prevail in the legislature. And in the long run, we are a much healthier democracy if we eliminate supermajority rules for regular legislation. And that may be, well, I mean, don't be shocked. Don't be shocked, and this is the last thing I'll say about it. If the Republicans win the presidency and the Senate, if they themselves don't come under huge pressure to eliminate the filibuster, I think they probably will do it, and I actually will support it if they do it.
And my question is, if you can share anything about the international landscape and the trends, like not just in the U.S., but different parts of the world. I'm originally from Mexico. I'm trying to understand how these trends are affecting not just the U.S. democratic system, but the international democratic system that somehow we are all being affected.
I worry a fair amount about what happens in another Trump term. Clearly, the United States, if it was ever a model for democracy in the world, is ceasing to be that. And this happened before. The U.S. democracy promotion was slowing down before Trump, so I shouldn't assign all of this to Trump. But the U.S., there are a number of cases in the world where the United States just folded its hands, where it could have played a role in defending democracy under Trump. In Honduras, it was arguably a stolen election, and the Trump administration didn't give a damn. So I worry that the global environment for democracy will get worse if democracy continues to backslide in the United States, or if we fall into a period of crisis and instability. That will, I think, probably accelerate a bit what has been so far a pretty modest decline in global democracy.
You were just listening to Stephen Levitsky on Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Stephen Levitsky is professor of government at Harvard and co-author of Tyranny of the Minority. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Stephen Levitsky on Tyranny of the Minority, and for his book, Tyranny of the Minority, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Thank you. there, folks.
RCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.